You are about to hear a live broadcast on heritageradionetwork.org. You are about to hear a live broadcast on heritageradionetwork.org. You are about to hear a live broadcast on heritageradionetwork.org. You are about to hear a live broadcast on heritageradionetwork.org. The following program has been brought to you by Rolling Press, a family-run, eco-friendly printing company. For more information, visit rollingpress.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning, everybody. It's Sunday. That means it's a live edition of The Main Course. I am your host, Patrick Martins. We're broadcasting out of Roberta's Restaurant at 261 Moore Street in Bushwick, Brooklyn. We are engineered by Jack Inslee, who's substituting in for Joe Galarraga. Welcome back, Jack.
Hey, thanks. It's been a while.
Is this your first Sunday in the studio in a while?
Yeah, a real long time.
Yeah, you got too big for Sundays, huh?
Yeah, I wanted to wait till the weather got nice again.
Just when they thought you had moved out of the situation, it pulled you back in because Joe is going to South by Southwest, right?
Yeah, I think he's going to call into the network a little bit later, actually.
Well, very interesting. That's in Austin, and we have an Austin resident in studio with us, and he's going to come on in a few minutes. Patrick Fitzsimmons, who is the vice president of your parents are listening and being like, well, that's news to us. Thunderheart Bison Ranch.
I had to put something down.
Yeah, we're going to talk about bison, America's national meat. We're also going to talk to Peter DeGarmo about the city of Portland. I've been watching Portlandia, and I needed to know what was true about Portlandia and what was not true. And Peter is going to give us the lowdown. Peter DeGarmo opened up Pasta Works in 1983 on Hawthorne Avenue, years and years before that neighborhood got rehabilitated and years before people really thought about sustainable foodways and this and that in the city of Portland. So be very interesting to see how Portland's changed over the past 30, 40 years. But, you know, in our intro, in case people have not heard, and for people who forgot that this is Daylight Savings Time, they're going to hear an hour later and have to listen to this as a repeat. But if you did change your clocks, this is news. A fire broke out. Kind of tragic. Early Friday morning at Chez Panisse. Alice Waters, this is, of course, Alice Waters' pioneering restaurant in Berkeley, California, made famous by its embrace of organic food. The fire, which was reported at 3:04 a.m., badly damaged the restaurant's front porch, that beautiful wooden front porch. No one was injured. Alice, I talked to her yesterday, and she was sad to lament that the facade is gone. You know, she opened Chez Panisse in 1971, and the facade had been standing since then. And the fire started under the front porch, she said, and it just burned the whole front porch off. We were lucky that it happened in the middle of the night and that no one was there, but it's gone. So, you know, it kind of puts things into perspective. You know, time passes, things change. It's part of the way the world works. But, you know, it kind of made me think, will Chez Panisse exist in 100 years? You know, will Lupa exist in 100 years? Will, you know, Rick Bayless's restaurants in Chicago, Frontera Grill, will that be around in 100 years? And when will that end? You know, when will these restaurants close? Things of that nature. And I don't know, it's just kind of sad to think about people getting older, things changing, things closing, people dying. But, you know, of course, we are big fans of Alice Waters. She's on the advisory board of Heritage Foods. She's been a big helper to us here at the Heritage Radio Network. And, you know, just like Berkeley is kind of the epicenter of the organic movement, so too is Kansas City, where we work, is kind of the epicenter of the heritage breed movement. There just happen to be hundreds and hundreds of small family farms in the Kansas City area, you know, Kansas, Missouri, that raise rare breeds. And I've been doing research for a book I'm writing, and a big part of that is the fecundity. The, you know, what's the word? Fecund means kind of a powerhouse of production. It's like the Flint Hills there are the largest remnant of the tall grass prairies left in the United States. So you have all these, you know, blue stem and all these beautiful natural earth grasses that are, you know, very potent and very nourishing and very sweet and delicious to free-ranged animals. So, you know, that has become an epicenter of the heritage breed movement for a reason. And anyway, it's just... we feel connected to Alice and to everything, and it's very sad when things burn down. But I guess we'll start our show. We have Patrick Fitzsimmons, the vice president of Thunderheart Bison. Welcome, Patrick.
Thank you.
Patrick was helped us at Heritage Foods about 7-8 years ago when he was a student at Sarah Lawrence College. And he went home to help his parents launch the business. And now he's back on a sales trip, you know, trying to launch a new chapter for Thunderheart Bison. So, Patrick, I want to ask you, why should we care about bison if it hasn't taken off as much as beef? You know, leanness is nice and healthy, but when people eat meat, they want beef in this country. So how would you answer that?
Well, it's not so much about the specific animal of bison, but so much as how it's raised. Bovine animals are designed to eat grass. They're not designed to be in a feedlot, eating grain for half of their lives, and then going straight to the slaughterhouse. They need to be grass-fed, and then, if possible, like we do, they need to be harvested out in the field where the animal feels the least amount of stress.
So do you shoot them out in the field, or do you have a mobile abattoir? Explain to our listeners how Thunderheart's operation works and how many bison you have.
Yeah, that's right. We shoot the animals in the field. We take about 7 animals right now every other month. So our production rate is a little bit down because of the recent drought. But we don't have a mobile abattoir. We've got a permanent abattoir in place where the animals are skinned and quartered. And then the rest of the fabrication is done at Uvalde Meats down the road, where they do all of our ribeyes, New York strips, sirloins, all the roasts.
So how do you, you can shoot them anywhere, or do you have to kind of herd them? Is there a rotating pasture thing that you do?
Or
are they,
yeah,
how many acres are they on? How many bison do you have?
We've got about 100 bison right now. It's a little bit down in numbers because of the recent drought. But, you know, we're hoping and praying for some more rain. So
how much is the ideal land per bison? How much land does each bison need to truly be free-ranged in the right way?
It varies on, you know, how much moisture the land is getting per year. But we like to at least have 30 to 40 acres per animal.
30 to 40 acres per animal.
Yeah, I mean, it's good to maintain that kind of separation because we've got a saying that density breeds disease. And when you have a lot of animals pinned up together in the same area, there's a higher risk of disease happening.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Now, you would have more bison, but water is a real issue down. Now, you're talking about, you're near Carrizo Springs, about 2 hours from San Antonio, right?
Just about, yeah.
So, is that, water is your biggest obstacle to growing the bison supply, right?
Yeah, just lack of precipitation, basically. 2011 was our, was pretty much the worst year on record for us. It's gotten a little bit better since then, but we've got a long way to go.
Is this part of global warming, or is that just a bad area for rain in general?
Well, You know, some scientists have done studies on this, and they've taken core samples out of trees that are hundreds and hundreds of years old, and they've basically determined that our natural pattern in Texas and most of the Southwest is short periods of rain followed by very long periods of drought, in which you get very dry seasons and then flash floods. So I think we're going to be in a pattern similar to that for this foreseeable future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, very, very interesting. So how old are bison when they're killed?
We take the bulls at about 2 years old and the cows later than that.
And so how much do they weigh at that point?
Oh, it varies, but at least like 500 to 800 pounds.
Definitely. So where did you buy your first bison?
We bought our first bison at some auctions around Texas and just slowly built up the herd from different sources. We bought some from Colorado and Oklahoma.
Do genetics matter, or is a bison a bison a bison?
Oh, yes. Genetics definitely matter. Some of the animals in our herd are from a place called Caprock Canyon, which is in North Texas, where the remnants of the Charles Goodnight bison herd. It's a really interesting story. Charles Goodnight was a famous cowboy that Larry McMurtry based his book Lonesome Dove on. Lonesome Dove, exactly. And his wife, Mary Ann Goodnight, saw this enormous slaughter that was going on with the bison in the 1870s and saw the need for preserving some of them. So she basically got Charles to round up a herd of bison. And that herd is still around today in Caprock Canyon in Texas. And some of our bison we bought from that herd. So we have those original kind of Texas bison genetics.
So bison were on the brink of extinction at the beginning of the 20th century.
They were.
Wow, really overhunted. So now bison have never been domesticated.
No.
Although you do say that once they touch the hand of man and man's hand touches them, they somehow become less wild?
Yeah. I would say, they've been maybe forcibly domesticated. A lot of the bison are basically treated too similar to cattle, in my opinion. They're worked around into chutes and just treated not really how bison should be treated, because they're naturally wild animals. They need to be able to run around without too much human interference.
Now, you say yours are just shot in the in the field and then brought to a place that eviscerates them, and then they're brought to an official processing plant that cuts them up.
Right.
Is that how, I know the answer to this, but that's not how most bison are raised in the United States. Could you talk about the quote-unquote feedlot bison out there, and is that the right word for
them? They're raised on, the feedlot bison are raised on grass in the beginning and then taken to a feedlot to finish out, to basically gain as much weight as possible.
So it's the opposite of what you just said. They're not running around. They're just kind of in a... And does your bison taste better as a result?
Oh, yes.
Why? And can you describe that taste in words? Because it is exquisite.
It is.
I tasted it, really, but what about it translates into the meat? Like, what words do you and your family use to distinguish how your bison tastes versus, commodity bison?
Well, if you eat the commodity bison and commodity steaks, you can taste the chemicals in there. You can taste the grain. You can taste the vaccinations, the antibiotics, all of that stuff. If an animal is only fed grass its entire life, you can taste the difference in that. And I've even had some of my customers even say, oh, the bison this week tasted like buffalo grass, or it tasted like this other kind of grass. They can really pick out the very subtle differences in the flavor.
So how intelligent are bison?
Oh, they're very intelligent. We don't wean the bison or take them away from their family groups. So they all exist in small family groups of 10 to 13, 10 to 15 animals. And
groups of 10?
No. I don't know how many groups there are. That's just the that's the basic size of a group. Yeah.
But are all your 100 bison together in one big group, or do they kind of go off onto their own? And
some of them go off onto their own, and then they get together at other seasons. It's a seasonal thing, like when they get together for the for mating season and then for calving season, they're together more.
So what's the pecking order of the herd?
Well, it's just whoever's the biggest, strongest bison gets to
mate with all the females?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, a lot of people in cattle before have used artificial insemination to get the best steer, when really if you just let nature do its business, you get the best animal.
So they do naturally mate. So one bison will... So how many men are there and how many females in the herd? And is that important to think about when you buy a herd?
Oh, yeah. I'm not sure exactly what the ratio is, but there's more females than males.
More females than males. Yeah, and are any of the males castrated or anything?
No, no, we don't. Like, they're wild animals, and that would be very dangerous.
And if they fight, do you have to remove one bison from the rest of the herd? They just figure it out?
No, yeah, we don't interfere with their personal problem.
Do they ever fight?
Yeah.
Do they kill each other?
In very rare cases, it's been known to happen, but it's very rare.
What are their personalities like? I mean, if you were to describe the day in the life of a buffalo, I mean, are they... I mean, I've always heard that they'll, you know, kick your ass. Like, if you see one in Yellowstone National Park, you're supposed to get the hell out of there because they'll kill you.
I know. I think that's a little exaggerated. They can attack you, but only if you provoke them. There's been a lot of cases of tourists doing things like throwing objects at them in order to get their attention, and that's definitely not a good idea. But I wouldn't characterize just seeing a bison that you should be afraid and run away immediately. I mean, most of them are pretty docile and glad to have you around as long as you don't present a threat to them. And during the calving season, when the calves are around, they're much more volatile and dangerous to be around because bison females are extremely protective of their young.
And what is that? They have that brown fur around their neck. Is that just fur? I mean, is that is there a purpose for that? And is that wool ever used for, you know, clothing or anything like that?
Yeah. It makes, we haven't utilized the wool yet, although my mom and sister, Evelyn, are working on the bison leather business, doing purses, bags, bracelets, all that kind of stuff. And
well, that's an important thing because A, it adds value, but B, bison leather has like 1,000 times more follicles than cow leather. So as a result, you get very, very supple leather.
It holds together. It doesn't break. You just
So tell us about that side of the business.
Yeah, we've been doing the leather for quite a while. It's all designed by my mom and my sister, like I said. And we just recently came out with a new line of leather products. We've got purses, wallets, a glasses case, a bracelet. And yeah, you can go to thunderheartbison.com and you can order it up and we'll ship it out to you.
So now what is the, how does it work? You kill the bison, the leather gets shipped down to... Mexico. I mean, how did you partner with those people? And yeah, because everyone is always talking about, oh, we got to do something with the hides,
right,
very few people go through.
Yeah, I mean, we're lucky that we have our own facility where we can keep the hides. Most small little processing plants will take the hide as part of the deal and then they will sell it to a leather place somewhere else. So we're lucky that we have the hides that we can use and and utilize it for sure.
Now, where is your bison sold? I know there's the famous Hut's Hamburger.
That's right.
And Hillside Pharmacy. Mm-hmm. So describe, I mean, Hut's Hamburger is like a pretty famous Austin place, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great place. That was one of our first accounts that we got in Austin. And we also, like you said, there's the Hillside Pharmacy. That's a really fantastic restaurant in Austin, and there's another place in San Antonio called The Cove that's really good. And then about a little over a year ago, I launched my own endeavor that's the Thunderheart Bison trailer.
The Ranch to Trailer.
Ranch to Trailer, right. And it goes just direct. And
did you ever think about turning that trailer into an abattoir as well, so it's abattoir straight into steaks?
Wow, that would be quite the endeavor.
Something for the future.
Yeah, maybe in the distant future.
So yeah. So tell us about this Thunderheart Bison. Is there a big movement towards food trucks out in the Texas area?
In Austin there is, definitely. It's definitely. I recently moved the trailer to San Antonio, next to the San Antonio College campus on Lexington and Main there.
What prompted that move? I mean, I would think Austin has a...
Yeah. It does,
community,
but
there that's hot for that stuff.
Yeah, it does, but there's a lot of trailers in Austin. There's a lot of, and I think San Antonio is kind of a burgeoning market a little bit.
So tell us what's prepared there. Do you drive the thing around?
Or? No. It's in one permanent spot, and we run the gamut kind of. We do burgers, tacos. We've got a short rib and mashed potatoes dish, an Asian steak salad. My chef Catherine New came up with a great new thing called Tachos, which is tater tots and nachos, but with nacho tater tots.
Bison.
Yeah, and bison, of course.
So break down the animals. So that mm-hmm. place buys mainly the ground. I mean, predominantly, right?
Yeah, mainly ground. And, we do a bison hash that we make out of the hump roast.
The hump roast.
It's fantastic.
Is the hump roast like the round, the back, the kind of ham end?
It's the hump. It goes directly behind their head. Yeah, so I like it a lot. It's one cut that's very unique to bison. You don't find it on a cow or anything.
They don't have humps?
No.
Well, very interesting. Now, what percentage of the animal do you grind up, and what percentage of the animal do you sell? I mean, do you sell the round, the kind of hind and all that? I mean, is there a demand for all that? Or are you grinding up 50% of the animal, 30%, 70%?
I can't give you a specific percentage on what we grind up, but the ground is the majority of the business, definitely. Over 50%, I'd say.
The hamburger. Yeah. And what is what does it cost to eat your bison at these at your truck? $10?
Yeah, about for a burger. Burger's $9. And we try to keep the prices pretty reasonable.
So it's a little bit more expensive than fast food, but not by that much.
Not by that much, for sure.
Very interesting.
We're not going to charge an arm and a leg.
Well, we're going to take a short break, and then we're going to hear about this is a terrible acronym, FARFA, but it does stand for the Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance, of which Patrick is a very active member. So we're going to come back and discuss FARFA.
You're listening to Spreadin' Honey by the California Honey Drops on heritageradionetwork.org.
You better do what you want when you get up in the morning, 'cause it won't be long before you're dead and gone.
Yeah,
no, there ain't no telling. Yeah, we all just bet. Just plan our hand.
Today's program has been brought to you by Rolling Press. Rolling Press is a family-run commercial offset print house that brings together environmentally friendly methods, ethical practices, and personalized service. Founded in 1998 by Eugene Lee and his father, Cam Lee, Rolling Press represents the harmony of traditional craftsmanship and green technology. Rolling Press prints using soy and vegetable inks, uses a variety of certified and recycled papers, and they incorporate a chemical-free production process. For more information, visit rollingpress.com. Every Tuesday at 12 p.m., you can call food scientist Dave Arnold and ask any question you want.
John from Chicago, you're on the air.
Hey, Dave.
Cooking issues!
Who am I fooling? This is horrible stuff. Without glutamic acid, you die!
It is a matter of taste, but there's a lot more fat in sausage than you think.
Get ahead of the curve. Tune into Cooking Issues every Tuesday at 12 p.m. on heritageradionetwork.org.
Well, we're back. Jack, pretty big week, huh?
Oh, man, yeah.
At Heritage Radio Network, I mean, you have had some really big guests coming in. I mean, Tom Colicchio. How was that?
It was great. Yeah,
yeah, you produced that piece. What was he talking about? What did he have to say? This is, of course, Tom Colicchio, chef of Kraft, Colicchio and Sons, used to work at Gramercy Tavern, and, of course, now famously Top Chef.
You know, he said something interesting. He said he's been working at so many restaurants and he never stayed anywhere for too long, so he said he has no mentor, which is like the first time I've heard a big chef say that. Usually they all have somebody they consider a mentor.
Interesting. Well, how did you take that?
I don't know. He's kind of an independent spirit, I guess. But you know, he said that he doesn't take the Top Chef stuff too seriously. He's pretty interested in issues of hunger because his wife, Lori Silverbush, directed A Place at the Table, which is a new documentary exploring hunger in this country that Michelle Nishan had a lot to do with and a lot of other people. So that was a big focus in the interview and very interesting to hear him speak about.
Now, I mean, what kind of guy? I mean, I would imagine, was he approachable? Because, I mean, to have those two successful restaurants and then be, you know, a superstar on television with Padma, the beautiful Padma, who used to be married to Salman Rushdie, the Satanic Verses lady. I met her once. Everyone was like, oh, she's going to come pick up her turkey at the meat shop. I'm like, ah, whatever. Those TV shows, they don't mean anything. I don't care about her. And then she walked in looking like $1 million. I was just like, oh, my God. Padma, can I take your turkey to your car for you? So,
he was very approachable. No, all the interns came and hung out with him, and he took a bunch of pictures with everybody. We showed him around Roberta's. He was great.
Fantastic. What did he think of the back of Roberta's? You took him into... Blanca and all that?
Oh, yeah. It's always fun to surprise the Blanca staff with a celebrity chef.
I love doing that, too.
I remember I brought Eric Repair back there, and everybody dropped what they were doing, and they were like, Chef! Hi, Chef! Great to meet you.
Chef! Yeah, it's like a military in a lot of those kitchens. So who else? Anyone? Did you ever get Walt Clive Frazier to come?
No, you know, I'm still hounding him. He's got to come call us in soon. But a lot of other interesting things happening this week. We have a Passover special that'll debut later in the week.
You just have to tell Walt Clive Frazier, procrastination will keep you from this destination.
And this radio station.
Yes. But and who do you have? Say again.
A Passover special later in the week that will be airing in conjunction with The Forward, which is a Jewish magazine. And Leah Eden did a lot of work on that. So I'm excited to release it later this week.
Well, thanks. Thanks for not playing that sound effect. No, just kidding. That is exciting. Leah Eden's doing a great job for us. Well, anyway, we are in studio with Patrick Fitzsimmons, the vice president and soon to be president of Thunderheart Bison Ranch. And now you are a generalist.
Yeah.
So what does that mean? I find myself a generalist. Define generalist.
Generalist, pretty simply, somebody who knows a little bit about a whole lot of things.
So, but do you know a lot about anything?
There's a few things I know a lot about.
You know a lot about sports.
Yeah, yeah.
And what else? So you know a little bit about a lot? I mean, does that make it difficult to pick what you want to do in the future?
It does. It really does. Yeah.
Because everything fascinates you a little bit.
Yeah.
So one of the things that you do on the side is work for the Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance.
That's right.
Who's their constituency and what is their mission?
Their constituency is small farms and ranches around Texas, their owners, and then the consumers that buy their products. And what we're trying to do is make it easier for the product to get from the farm to the consumer with as little kind of governmental bureaucratic intervention as possible.
So describe that. Like, what kind of products are you talking about? Bison or jams or what? Who are you fighting for?
Everything. Well, this session we've got a few bills up. One is called the Raw Milk Bill. Or HB 46.
And where does this bill exist? This is with the...
It's in the Texas legislature.
Texas legislature, mm-hmm. Which, if I recall correctly, only meets 6 months out of every 2 years.
Every other year, yeah.
That is so interesting. So they work 6 months every 2 years. But they have other...
It might be like 8 months.
But they have other jobs, obviously, because this doesn't pay very well, right? I mean, right. It's more of a volunteer position, basically.
Well, they get paid about $7,000.
$7,000 to be this. Who are these people who run the legislature? How many are there and what regions do they represent? I mean, is it a large group?
I think there's 180 some odd. I don't want to say the exact number because I'm...
And they're community leaders, basically, who get voted by the population?
Oh, yeah, they get elected. Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
They run and they make posters and such?
Yeah, exactly.
And now they do, obviously, other things, but one side of what they do is food.
Right. Well, there's bills about food. There's the Agricultural Committee and the Public Health Committee and things like that, yeah.
Okay, and so tell us about these 7 bills and why we should care. Well, I mean, because it's interesting stuff.
Yeah. I'll just go over just a couple of them. The Raw Milk Bill, I think, is the one that's getting the most attention this session. Raw milk is already legal in Texas to buy, but there's a pretty heavy restriction on it in that if you want to go buy it from the farmer, you have to drive directly to his farm to go and buy it.
That's the only place where it's legal is straight from the farm that's making it?
That's right.
So no stores, no farmers market?
No.
What's up with that? Why?
You know, that's our question. That's basically our question. Why
do they feel like it's being sanctioned as an as a product if it appears at stores? Whereas if you buy it on the farm, it's like buy at your own risk.
This is an important distinction. The bill does not say that it should be in grocery stores. We don't want it in Whole Foods or Central Market. The bill very specifically says it can either be at farmers markets or farm stands or designated drop-off points. So that's a big distinction there, is we only want to make it available at farmers markets to satisfy that that need that consumers have.
Because some people want raw milk.
Yes, absolutely.
And is it so this is basically for the small producer of raw milk deserves a little bit more of an organized effort to sell it.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, so you're fighting for that. Now, what other bills are you fighting for?
There's a cottage food bill, which is really interesting. They passed one at the last session that said if a producer of a non-hazardous food item, such as jams or jellies or mixed nuts or something like that, wants to produce food in their home, as long as they're only selling up to $50,000 a year of that product, they can produce it inside their house and sell it without the official state of Texas label on there, as long as they have their name, their address, where you find them. And these sales are being made directly from the producer to the consumer, so you know who you bought it from.
Very interesting. Now, of course, there's a risk that someone could cook something in their home. It's dirty. Would there be regulators to go into their homes to make sure that it's an approved kitchen, for instance, and that it's clean?
No.
No. So is this for the teacher? Is this for the producers? Or is this against government kind of thing?
No, we're not against government.
Against regulation and all that. It's basically just trying to open up the market to people who, as to date, have not gotten access to
it. No, that's exactly right. It's for the young entrepreneur that wants to have a food business that he can grow slowly to generate a little bit of revenue to then reinvest in going the whole nine yards with getting the commercial kitchen and the label and everything, just kind of like a little boost, a starting out point. And then it's also for kind of the baker who just wants to bake like one fancy wedding cake, and then sell it. I don't know what wedding cakes go for, probably a lot these days.
Especially down in Texas.
Yeah.
Oil rich Texas.
Yeah.
So, right. So it would kind of open it up to different people. And who do you lobby? So, I mean, do you approach this legislation board of 180 people and make a speech in front of them and then they vote on it the next week? I mean, what is the process of who are you trying to get the message out to?
Well, yeah, it goes through a committee, first of all. Most of our bills, some of them are going through the Public Health Committee. Some of them are going through the Agriculture Committee. So, we visit those legislators and kind of lay out what we're doing and have discussions on that. And then they have a hearing where both for and against cases are made. And then hopefully when they get out of committee, there will be a floor vote. And then hopefully if it gets out of the House, it'll go to the Senate. And if it's successful there, then the governor will sign it into law.
Hmm.
Yeah. We got a bunch of steps to go through, but
do you still have to line up some ducks, or do you think you're almost all the way there?
Oh, we've got a long ways to go.
We've
already had a hearing on our raw milk bill, and that actually went very well. So I'm feeling good about that.
Very interesting. Yeah, I know my wife is in cheese, and there's raw milk issue is always there, and it's funny that the raw milk is prohibited because of the off chance of someone, you know, getting sick, and yet, you know, huge companies that are producing pasteurized cheeses make people sick a lot of the time too. I mean, it's not like that's a foolproof system either, you know, the whole pasteurization process. And I think raw milk is a nutritious thing for certain people.
Like
certain people need
raw milk. It's amazing. It is so good. It's amazing how good it is.
So are you prohibited from lobbying on behalf of bison issues?
No. No, there's actually another bill in front of the legislature this session called the Stray Bison Bill, which basically says that if your bison gets off of your land, your neighbor doesn't have just an absolute right to shoot it.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, it's an issue I've run up to a lot here in Carroll Gardens, Brooklyn. I hate when my bison get out and they get shot. But
it's bad, yeah.
you think you're going to stay in bison? I mean, do you have a desire to see bison meat get consumed more? And also, raising it your way seems so time intensive and expensive. Like, could it ever feed the world?
Yeah, I don't think that it's something where you can you have to sacrifice and do less bison in order to do it the right way. I think that a lot of the grass-fed operations in the country could, if they wanted to, they probably could do it our way. And I think the meat just overall in America would be a lot healthier and better for you if they followed a system more similar to ours.
Yeah, well, your bison are healthy, and cows need antibiotics in their feed just to not get sick, because they're not really raised in the best of circumstances.
Exactly. Yeah.
So do you have a website for us, Pat?
Yeah, it's thunderheartbison.com.
And you can buy the bags and the ground and all the cuts there?
You can only buy the bags right now. We're still working on getting our website set up to where we can do shipping, but hopefully that'll happen in the near future.
Well, very, very good. Well, I hope you'll sit in for this interview with Peter DeGarmo. Feel free to chime in, but we will take a very short break, and we do really thank Patrick Fitzsimmons from coming all the way in Austin just to do this radio's in studio.
Thanks, Patrick.
Please don't say you love me when you do how you do. Please don't say you care. Girl, I know you've been untrue. Well, it ain't hard to tell. You've been seeing somebody new. So please don't kiss and hug me the way he wants you to. I said, the way he wants you to.
You're listening to It Ain't Hard to Tell by the California Honey Drops on heritageradionetwork.org.
We are back with Peter DeGarmo. Peter, are you on with us?
I am here. How are you, Patrick?
Wow, very nice. You were an old school guy, so I was like, telephone? I didn't even know if you would have access to a telephone when you're not at work, because you are old school. I'm really happy to have you on the station for the first time. Since 1983, Peter DeGarmo has Pasta Works, a lovely market on Hawthorne Avenue. He has since opened one more. And Pasta Works is really an amazing store that is, sells unbelievable selection of Piedmont wines, but also fresh fruits and vegetables and cheeses and charcuterie. And it's connected to a very cool bookstore. So we'll learn more about the store throughout the course of the interview. But I'm fascinated to know, especially with Portlandia and everyone talking about Portland, how has the food culture changed most significantly in Portland since you started work in 1983?
I think basically it's expanded dramatically and diversified particularly in the context of producers from the wine industry and obviously the craft beer trades and cheeses and spirits. And also diversified in terms of the population of the city. The city's grown. I've lived here since the mid-70s, and the population, I think, when you moved here was like 380,000, 390,000, and now it's 580,000. So, and that's just in the city, not just the suburbs around the city or Vancouver, Washington. So the diversity's occurred, but it mirrors a lot of what's happened in the rest of the country, obviously, because there were urban renewal projects in the 60s and early 70s that destroyed whole swaths of the cityscape and eliminated ethnic neighborhoods in particular. And that rebuilding has occurred over the last 10 to 15 to 20 years.
So who was there with you? I mean, what reception did Pasta Works get in 1983? I mean, was there a community, the ingredients of a food movement there already? And were there other shops like yours? Or were you really, alone out there? I know Hawthorne Avenue was not the best neighborhood back in 1983, and you were certainly a reason behind the rehabilitation of that neighborhood. But Who was there? I mean, who came into your store at first, or were you immediately adored by a community that was looking for quality ingredients?
A little of both, because there, again, had been food shops existing throughout the city that essentially disappeared in the late 60s and early 70s. We opened in the middle of a recession, and as you mentioned, Hawthorne Boulevard was kind of deserted and bleak at the time. There were a couple of other places on the boulevard. There was a place called Sunnyside Bakery, because it's in the Sunnyside neighborhood of Portland. And a new restaurant had just opened on the street called Bread and Ink, and Bread and Ink was owned at the time by four people who had worked together at kind of the icon of Portland restaurants, a place called the Genoa. So there were a couple of other places on the boulevard, but not many. And
so the Genoa was kind of like the Chez Panisse of Portland, right? And I remember, wasn't there a famous chef named Kathy Wims that used to work there and be the chef?
Yes. Kathy was, I think, originally started maybe as a dishwasher at the Genoa. And it's cultivated generations of restaurant people in the city. The people who came to us initially were friends and neighbors. And my partner at the time and I had no food experience other than eating and drinking.
Who was that, Don Oman?
Yes, that was Don. And we had had some experience doing community organizing. We had both been unemployed for a couple of years. So we knew people in the immediate neighborhood, and they were our first customers. And then kind of word of mouth spread throughout the city, and we started to draw people from across the river.
So tell us, what was that? Did you have all the space that you had now? No, I mean, now I know you have a kind of semi-bar restaurant area, but did you have that whole big space, and were you connected to the bookstore back then, or was it just a tiny market?
No, that was, again, kind of an organic and kind of maybe a typical Portland experience. The space that's now the little eating space, which we call Avo, was the original space, and so we... Don and I made pasta in there. There were a handful of wines. There were some cheeses. We occasionally made sauces and other things. And about 2 years after we opened, the space next to us, which had been Sally's Resale Boutique, became open. And for whatever reasons, we decided to move into that space. And about 2 years into that, there's the large dog in the background. The space next door to that became open. And Michael Powell walked into the store one day. Michael Powell owns Powell's Bookstore in Portland. And we kind of asked him, without knowing what we were asking, have you ever thought about a cookbook store? And he said, well, I don't know. Let me think about it. And he came back the next day and said, that's a good idea. So he opened a cookbook store in that enlarged space. And someone we knew who made sausage at the time, a fellow from upstate New York, Fred Carlo, opened the Sella Maria de Carlo, and the three of us shared a common checkout counter and a common space.
So communist of you. I love it. Now, because of the terroir there, Peter, places like the Willamette Valley, what items did you feature and do you feature at your markets that couldn't be found maybe as fresh or as pure as other markets in the country?
Well, we're schizophrenic in that way, because obviously we have a Mediterranean theme, so there's a lot of Italian wine, and we make our own pasta. The wheat that we used once upon a time came from eastern Oregon, and now Pendleton Mills, I think, is based in South Carolina or somewhere, so we're trying to find resources other than that. But we also do local cheeses, and what you're really asking is, what does the area produce that other areas don't produce? And again, it's a little bit like the rest of the country. Places that were famous for things 20 and 30 years ago are no longer famous for those things because they don't make economic sense to cultivate or grow. But Oregon is, the Willamette Valley in particular, is very strong in cane berries, even though the cane berry market has shrunk because people are looking for berries that survive transportation across the country. So a lot of the really quality Oregon fruit goes into preserves and jams and things.
But, now, of course, you were never about all local, right? Because you were also about gastronomy and yep. What things tasted the best. And there'd be certain things like the cane berry, which obviously makes sense to eat locally. But, for instance, the wine movement just didn't exist in 1983. So what is the connection between Portland and northern Italy, or just Italy in general, like Italian wines? You know, Portland goes through a lot of Italian wine as a city, does it not?
It does. It, at one time, it was, I don't know if this is still true, but 5 or 6 years ago, it was the second largest market, per capita market, outside of New York for Italian wines. And some of that reflects, obviously, the growth of the Oregon wine industry, which is based primarily in the Willamette Valley, but also other parts of the state. Some of the varietals, while not Italianate, at least in their production, resembled what was going on in Italian wines. And you have to remember that the Italian wine industry, in many cases, is also very new and kind of parallels the growth of the Oregon wine industry. There's a wine writer in town by the name of Matt Kramer, who still writes, I think, for The Spectator, who's always been fond of Italian wines. And we got onto the Italian wine bandwagon very early and pursued everything that we could find at the time. There's a direct link between Oregon and Piedmont in some ways because of other agricultural production. Oregon is the largest producer of filberts or hazelnuts in the country, which obviously thrive in Piedmont. And I have to shout out to one particular person from Piedmont, which is Aldo Vacca from the Produttori del Barbaresco, who is kind of an international representative of all things Piedmontese.
Aldo Vacca, thanks for using the word shout out. God, you've done radio before. I can tell. No, Aldo Vacca, so what, did he come to Portland and meet with you and Don and say, hey, this is a city that'll be receptive to our wines, or how did that work?
Portland has always been a direct market for the wines from the Produttori del Barbaresco. So, and he pays an annual visit to his distributor here and obviously to lots of restaurants and wine shops. And again, not only represents his particular winery, but he represents in many ways all things Piedmontese. And that's generated and encouraged a large audience and reception in Portland.
And the wines are cheaper there. I mean, aren't the Piemonte wines just a little bit cheaper because there's so much volume going and such a good connection between the two zones?
It depends on the distribution network. So I don't want to name his national importer who happens to be in New York City.
Oh.
The wines do come directly into Portland, and generally are a little less expensive in Portland than they are on the East Coast.
Very, very interesting. So you were, there is a lot of connection. First of all, I just want to say, and we didn't even talk about this, so Peter, I'd love for you to come back in a few weeks and talk about the restaurant scene, because along with, Northern California, and by that I mean San Francisco, Berkeley, and Oakland, then, of course, New York and Brooklyn, Portland's right there in the top 5 cities in the country for food, and that's big chef collaborative scene. There was, of course, the big slow food scene, because you were the very first convivium or chapter leader of slow food in the United States. So would you think that the slow food chapter that you started was a little bit of a reason behind the kind of food culture that exists in Portland today?
I think in some ways it helped, because it simply established links with people in other places, and we became kind of the conduit for that kind of information sharing and the acknowledgement of things happening in other parts of the country, as well as in Italy and other parts of the world where slow food was organized. And we became associated with slow food early on, but it's obviously grown much more beyond that.
Has it? It grew, but now I would go back to the days when you started. That was a powerful convivium there. 80 to 100 members, monthly events. You had a school garden project, farm, that would grow food for the school, and wine events. You'd have Carlo Petrini come and visit. Very, very, very fascinating history there, and we could talk about that for an interview too. But I guess as the last question I have to ask, Peter, and I know you must hate getting this question, but what do you think of Portlandia? And is there any element of truth behind it? Because I think that show is hilarious.
I wonder how many Portlanders are listening to this, but there is a small amount of truth. My two favorite skit scenes are the lead-in to the very first program with the band marching up the East Side Esplanade and kind of gathering in mass as it marches up the Esplanade. And then I think in the second season, one of the episodes was on the allergy parade.
Oh, yes.
And a friend of my granddaughter's had a cameo face-only spot on that. And she's a very serious but very funny young woman. And my wife and I were watching it, saw Alice's face on the screen, and immediately broke out laughing. And a lot of it, frankly, Portland out Portlandia's Portlandia in many ways.
Oh, very nice, Jack. That is a tag. Portland out Portlandia's Portlandia in many Portland ways. Well, very fascinating. And I do have a website, Peter, for people to log on to, you know, and check links out of companies that you believe in locally and abroad.
It's very simple. It's pastaworks.com.
Pastaworks.com, and you have two locations, Hawthorne Avenue, and then the other one is what, called Downtown Portland, or what's
no,
that?
City Market in Northwest Portland.
City Market in Northwest Portland. Well, Peter, thanks so much for giving us a little time on a Sunday. Our love to Pat, your wife, who is a big energy around Portland and the hospital scene, and now at the Pastaworks scene again. So thanks so much for being on, and please wish her our best.
Take care, and thank you.
Okay, so, well, very interesting show. We have Pat Fitzsimmons, engineered by Jack Inslee. I'm Patrick Martins, and stay tuned for Straight No Chaser, hosted by Katie Kiefer.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.